Thank you, Henry Mancini. If Sunday night, then that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley of New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to 161st episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 160 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is JohnMack. Once again, that's johnmack13.com. My most recent and last piece, Third Westchester Guardian, is still available at that website, www.westchesterguardian.com. That's WESTCHESTERGUARDIN. It's the last of the Creative Disruption series, as after December 29th issue of the paper, The Westchester Guardian has joined the likes of New York Herald Tribune, Washington Star, New York Journal American, and Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. You will find links to the previous radio show, as I mentioned, and to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us each week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings live, or as most do, to listen later. You may go to the website at any time. And now to this show, the 161st in the series, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is Pulitzer Prize winner, college professor, Daily Beast columnist, David K. Johnson. I will talk about his impressive background and long body of work, and his most recent book, the highly acclaimed and quoted The Making of Donald Trump in the Free Will and Conversations Tonight. So let's get started. Good evening. Welcome to the show, David.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Before starting and getting to talk about Donald Trump, I must put on the record that I've long detested Donald Trump well before his political career, when Wayne Barrett was writing about his real estate dealing for the Village Voice and Trump was beginning to be interviewed on television. In 2009, I wrote the poem about my distaste for him and included it in my collection available on Amazon. Having said that, I have confidence that these feelings about Trump will not color this interview in any way. Now let's go back and start at the beginning with David. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in California. When we were very young, we lived on my grandmother's 3-acre orange ranch in the town of Orange, California. And then we moved to, when I was 8 years old, Northern California. And I regard Santa Cruz as home. I went to half of my school years there. And when I worked for the Los Angeles Times as a national investigative reporter based in San Francisco, I lived there back in the 70s. So that's home. But I also lived in L.A. and Orange County for about 10 years.
I know that due to necessity, you began working at the very young age. That must have been difficult, but I assume it also toughened you for a lifetime of investigative reporting. Care to comment on that?
I mean, you know, you do in life what you have to do. If you have parents who love you, I think everything else sort of works out. That's probably the single most important thing. I think there's lots of research that if kids have parents who love them, they can deal with anything else.
I also know that you went to a number of colleges and graduate schools, and although you did not receive a diploma from any of them, went on to write the textbook for Michigan State University Journalism Department. So three questions there. When along the way did you decide to be a journalist?
I began when I was 17 years old. I was a senior in high school, and I was hired to write a column for 20 cents an inch, which would be about $1.60, $1.90 an inch today, about the high school. And after my first column, they asked me to start doing other things, and so I pretty soon I'm covering the city council and the school board. And I did something that got a couple of things that got attention elsewhere. It was announced one day that, and I'm going to make up the numbers here, but that the school district tax would rise next year, and the announcement said something like, for the owner of the typical home worth $34,211, the property tax next year will rise by $42.03. Well, that's meaningless numbers unless you own a house worth exactly that amount of money. So I just longhand computed how much that was per thousand. And I literally, after I'd done this in a couple of stories, things like that, I had a reporter from the local daily come to me and say, you have to stop doing this. I don't know how you do this. And you know, I'm having trouble with my boss. And I thought, oh, this is very interesting. And I did a couple of investigations that, you know, were not very good because I was very young and self-taught. But when I was 18 years old, the San Jose Mercury, which is a large, prosperous, very, very prosperous newspaper, recruited me. And the next opening they had, they hired me when I was 19 years old, and I was on the front page of the San Jose Mercury within just a matter of weeks of being hired.
That's terrific. Why in the course of going to seven colleges did you never complete the degree program?
Well, when I arrived and went to junior colleges because I had grown up poor, not desperately poor, but, you know, not just marginally middle class. And college in California was free back then, unlike today. And frankly, I was bored. And luckily, a young man who sat next to me, who I never saw again after this one class, he said, well, why don't you just take upper division classes? And I went, they have those at a two-year college? And he says, oh, yeah, you just have to let the professor let you in. So I took 300, 400, and then when I went to San Francisco State and Michigan State and University of Chicago, I took courses all the way up to the doctoral level and didn't take the general ed requirements. So the last day that I remember going to college, I think I may have gone to one or two classes after this, I was in a course on Michigan State government where every week the professor would talk about the two biggest scandals involving state government. She read the local paper in Lansing, Michigan, and the Detroit News. I was the reporter at the Detroit Free Press whose stories she was talking about, and she never realized it was me, even though I kept asking questions in class and correcting things until she finally said, Mr. Johnston, I think it's become very apparent that you know more about this subject than I do. What are you doing here? And I walked out, and 15 years later at a cocktail party, she ran into my then boss, was telling this story when he said, well, yeah, that was so-and-so, and she had never figured it out.
How did you happen then to write that textbook?
There was a journalism professor who wanted a textbook about Michigan state government and where to find public records for an investigative reporting class. So I made a deal with him. I'll do the book. You give me a 4-unit A. And it was a required textbook when he taught at that school for a number of years. They ran it off, you know, as a mimeograph thing and put it in a little binder. And I still have the original typewritten copy of it.
The way you've written for a number of national known papers, would you take it briefly through your newspaper career?
Sure. Well, I stayed at the San Jose Mercury for 4.5 years. And when I left, I was still the youngest reporter at the paper. I was just turned 24. I then got my fellowship at the University of Chicago for 2 quarters. And I went to the Detroit Free Press in Lansing for 3 years. I'm the only investigative reporter, I think, who's ever been assigned to Lansing. Then the Los Angeles Times hired me in San Francisco as a national investigative reporter, and I later went down to L.A., worked for them for 12 years. I left and went to the Philadelphia Inquirer to cover Atlantic City in 1988 because I believed casino gambling was going to take a flight across the country, and we would have casinos pretty much everywhere we do now. And I wrote my first book back then, Temples of Chance, because to a lot of people, gambling is a religious experience. So Temples of Chance, How America, Inc. Took Over the Casino Business from Murder, Inc. And America Incorporated, Murder Incorporated. And then I went to the New York Times in 1995, and I was there for 13 years. And then I took a buyout from the Times And since then, I've been a columnist for a policy magazine called Tax Notes. I spent a little over a year as the worldwide economics columnist for Reuters. Wrote for them from Singapore and Korea and here in the U.S. And then I wrote for Al Jazeera America, which was a really professional, first-rate news organization as their lead columnist for about a year and a half, I guess. They shut down, and then I started writing for Investopedia and the Daily Beast, and I write for various other places. That I'll have a piece in the Times in a few days. I had a piece in the Daily News the other day, and then Salon, and I write who I want to write for these days.
Would you go into some depth about your Pulitzer Prize?
Well, my career when I was very young, taxes were a fundamental thing that got me ahead, was the different way that I covered taxes. And I've written about taxes on and off throughout my career. And when I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer, the great editor Gene Roberts, who ran the paper and who brought me into the paper, was very happy with the Pulitzer Prize-winning work done by Bartlett and Steele, who were the best investigative team the world's ever seen. But they also did things their way, which was a huge project every couple of years. And he was interested in having, in my idea, that we should do what I called a running investigation of the tax system. So when he was brought back to the New York Times, he had been the national editor of the New York Times when he left to fix up the Philadelphia Inquirer and turn it from one of the worst papers in America into one of the very best, he brought me into the New York Times. And the other editors thought I was going to cover taxes the way it had always been done at the Times, which is you're signed out of Washington and you cover what the government announces. And I remember my boss saying, well, here's who you talk to about moving to Washington. And I said, I'm not going to Washington. And he said, how can you cover the IRS without being in Washington? And I said, that's the whole point, is to not be in Washington, because if you do that, you end up covering what's conventional. What I'm going to do is cover the tax system as it actually operates. We're going to investigate how it functions in the real world, not what the politicians tell you about it. And this led to, I was a finalist. There are only three finalists. I was a finalist a total of four times for my tax coverage in the New York Times. I was a winner one of those four times in 2001 for exposing inequities and loopholes in the tax code. Congress changed a number of laws. The Clintons changed their personal tax filing. President George W. Bush made the only significant change in his tax policy during his two terms because of my work. A lot of people got prosecuted, and so many tax dodges that I exposed were shut down that Professor Richard Schmalbach, who's a noted tax law professor at Duke, called me the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States, which isn't true, but it was nice.
It's a great compliment. You've written a number of other books before the Trump one. Would you tell us a bit about them?
Sure. Well, I did the textbook for Michigan State. If I can digress for a minute, just to tell you that when I went in to say I wanted my degree, the young man who looked over my transcripts and my records said, well, you know, you haven't taken English. And I said, well, yes. And he said, well, you have to do that to show you can write. And I said, well, will this do? And I reached into my knapsack and I put out the book. And he said, what's that? I said, it's a required textbook. And he said, so you read it? And I said, no, take a look. I wrote it. And he went, oh, well, yes, perhaps we could pass you for not taking the necessary English requirements. So I wrote Temples of Chance in 1992, which was about the casino business. Much of it is about Donald Trump and his astonishing mismanagement of his casinos in Atlantic City. It has lots of colorful characters. It was bought as a movie by Hollywood, to my shock, because it was a public policy book, and I think I got paid for 17 years for the film rights to it, maybe 18 years, 17 or 18 years. Made more money off Hollywood of that book than off of sales of it. Then I wrote a trilogy from my years at the New York Times, Perfectly Legal, which was about how the tax system subsidizes many of the wealthiest Americans. Donald Trump is one of those people. And that won the Investigative Book of the Year award. Then I wrote Free Lunch, which was about subsidies to wealthy people that a lot of people know about now, but they didn't know about until I had written my book. And then I wrote a third book, The Fine Print, which was about restraint of trade, monopolies, getting rid of competition, you know, rules that, pick your pocket by violating the basic principles of market economics and market capitalism. Then I did, that was in 2012. In 2014, I edited an anthology called Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, and had a whole host of people who contributed chapters to look at inequality, which I tended to write about in terms of wealth and income, went into healthcare, environmental hazards, a whole variety of other issues. And then this year, August 2nd, I came out with The Making of Donald Trump, which is on sale all around the world, and there's a German language version in Europe called the Akte Trump, which means the Trump file. And as soon as the election is over, I will go back to work on my next book, which is The Prosperity Tax, an entirely new federal tax code for the 21st century economy. Well, I'm drafting the statutory language. I'm not a lawyer. I'm drafting the statutory language and writing a narrative to explain why, for the fourth time in its history, America has to have an entirely new tax code, and why the one we have now cannot be reformed or fixed. And that's because our economy has changed. We actually have a very good federal tax system for 1960.
Okay. Now I'm to Trump. I believe you first started writing about him almost 30 years ago. Was that before the book? What started the coverage?
Well, when I went to Atlantic City in June of 1988, Donald Trump was the dominant figure in Atlantic City. He had two casinos at the time. He was clearly the most fascinating person. The other casinos were mostly owned by corporations, and they were run by the most boring suits imaginable. Few exceptions, but generally. And I was somewhat aware of Trump from the West Coast, knew he was somewhat of a figure, was aware of his book, The Art of the Deal. And as soon as I met him, which was a few days after arriving, I recognized that he's P.T. Barnum. He's selling you tickets to the Fiji Mermaid and the Incredible 200 Woman. And shortly after that, as I began asking about him, his competitors, executives at other casinos, as I met them and would ask about him, and government officials and gaming lawyers and a couple of big gamblers I met, and then Trump's own people, all said Trump doesn't know anything about the casino business. The polite phrase was, Donald's not an operator. And I was like, this is not possible. He can't not know the casino business. He's got two casinos. And people say, he doesn't know anything. So the first time we sat down for an interview, I deliberately said something to him false about the game of craps. And he incorporated the falsehood into my answer. And in case that had happened, asking people who you think are not on the up and up something to see if they will pick up a lie and run with it is a technique I teach young investigative reporters, among other techniques. So I had three other questions I sprinkled through the interview that also had false statements in them. And in each case, he assumed the accuracy of it. And that's when I realized that fundamentally he's a con artist. He will tell you whatever thinks you want to hear, and that he really, in fact, didn't know anything. And the subsequent troubles of his casinos demonstrated this. While other companies to this day are making good profits in the casino business in Atlantic City because they reinvested in their buildings, they reinvested in key personnel, they developed software systems for customer management, particularly Harrah's. Trump simply wanted money sent to him as fast as they could, and he, almost like a parasite. He was just sucking the life out of the host until the host collapses, and that's why his casinos were among the first to fail. In addition to a whole lot of other business mistakes of just colossal proportions that he made that I covered closely in 1990. And at the time, John, the coverage in the Wall Street Journal, the Village Voice, where Wayne Barrett worked, and the Philadelphia Inquirer was different from everybody else's. Everybody else's coverage was pretty much, look at this incredible, great businessman and unskeptical. We were the ones, Neil Barsky at the Wall Street Journal, until Trump got him fired, and Barrett and I, who would, you know, check the public record and show that a lot of what Trump was saying was just easily provable as not true.
Did you realize when you had that moment that that as Tony Schwartz has admitted in the last year, that the art of the deal was a complete fabrication?
Well, no, I didn't know that at the time. What I was struck by about the art of the deal was some of the things that he bragged about. I wrote in my book, Temples of Chance, for example, that he brags in the book about deceiving his partners. His first casino, Trump Plaza, which is in the very best location in the center of the boardwalk, that casino, Harrah's was his partners, and he brags in the book about deceiving them and tricking them. And I thought, that's just astonishing. I mean, first of all, they're partners, so under the law, you have a fiduciary obligation to your partners. And yet this man in a book brags about tricking them. He had not done any work. And the board of directors of the Holiday Inn Corporation, which included Harrah's, came to Atlantic City. So he hired crews to dig holes and refill them and create the appearance that they were working to trick these guys. And only one of the directors caught on to what was actually going on. The rest of them apparently thought they were actually doing real site work. And that's what struck me, was the brazenness of not just deceiving your partners. I mean, if he'd said that quietly in a cocktail party, saying, yeah, you know, I really got one over these guys, he brags about it in a book. That was just extraordinary. And then he wrote a lot of other things in the book that I realized were just nonsense at the time. But I didn't have anywhere near the scope of understanding that we got since Tony Schwartz spoke. And by the way, the reason Tony Schwartz can talk is that back then, Donald didn't sign him to what's called an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. If you volunteer for Donald Trump's presidential campaign this year, you're a volunteer, you're just licking envelopes somewhere or making phone calls, you will be required to sign a non-disclosure agreement that in essence says you'll never say anything negative about Donald Trump for the rest of your life. Now, I don't think that's an enforceable agreement, but just think about that. I've never heard of any politician ever doing anything like that for a political campaign.
Over the years, you've written much that contradicts his public persona. Get you mentioned for the recent book a number of times, interviews with him, in fact, him calling you at home. Today, he reacts to negative covers by cutting off contact with the reporter or even the publication itself. How do you explain his continued contact with you over the years?
Well, Donald's only called me when he wants to call me. I mean, he called me in April to threaten to sue me, and he didn't say anything of any substance. The purpose of his call was to intimidate me. Now, I was actually surprised when Trump called me on April 27th to do that, because Donald knows from conversations we've had in the past that I personally hunted down an especially vicious black-on-white killer. I'm white. And confronted that guy and got an innocent man freed from prison. He knows that I've run into one burning building and towards two others. He knows that I've lived through six riots, and that I've been roughed up by anti-war radicals, Teamsters, longshoremen. I don't intimidate. And so I was kind of surprised, but I thought, well, he's just in full-on mode intimidating people, because he's been threatening everybody with lawsuits, just as you see him doing now. Because he always wants to be in control, and with a relatively small group of journalists, primarily Wayne Barrett, Neil Barsky, when he was still a journalist, and me, he wasn't in control. And then all the years I didn't write about Donald, except maybe in passing here and there, I kept collecting files on him because I knew he would be important. Nothing may ever come of them, but that's one of the things I do. I mean, I have so many files on the Los Angeles Police Department, which I was the first reporter to seriously expose for its brutality and political spying and racism. and failure to solve crimes on Jack Welch, who used to be the head of GE, on Baron Hilton, the hotelier. I used to have to rent two storage lockers just to keep all the banker's boxes of records that I had.
I know that in 1990 you debunked his claim that at that time he was a billionaire. How did you unearth the material to produce that expose?
Well, I will tell you this story, and if you don't believe it, it's totally understandable. I was outside my office in Atlantic City. It was on the fifth floor of a building in Atlantic City, and I went over to the photocopy place across the street to send a fax because I didn't have a fax machine. And I met a young woman there on the curb who had Donald Trump's personal financial statement. And she was trying to make a copy of it and hoping she could sell it to somebody like the National Enquirer and make some money. Obviously, she was a clerk or a secretary in a law firm's office. And so I persuaded her that I would make a copy for her and give it to her, and she could get back to her office. And she came back later, and I met her on the street corner, and I gave her a copy of the document, and I had made one for myself. Now, I have to consider the possibility this was a setup, that somebody wanted me to get this thing, and they set up the story because she wouldn't tell me who she was or anything else. He had just that day or the day before had to turn over his personal financial statement in a lawsuit I'd been writing about. And so I broke the story that, he was not a billionaire. That was in April of 1990. Trump went ballistic about this. And then in August, the New Jersey Casino Control Commission made public another financial net worth statement, this one done by the banks that had loaned Trump money. And they put him as having a negative net worth of $295 million.
Wow.
Or as I wrote in the lead of my story in the Philadelphia Inquirer that morning was, you are probably worth more than Donald Trump.
Do you feel that he has reached the billionaire or even the multi-billionaire status by now?
There is no evidence whatsoever, and there never has been, that Donald Trump is a billionaire. I can't tell you what he is worth. He's a wealthy man. By any standard, he is a wealthy man. But there is absolutely no evidence that he is or ever was a billionaire. One of the things we don't know about Trump is all of his debt obligations. The way the presidential financial disclosures work, it is so full of holes that it was only because of the diligent work by some New York Times reporters that we found out that one of the entities he's an investor in owes a couple hundred million dollars to the Bank of China. Now, the Bank of China is the communist government of Beijing's state-owned bank. And just stop and think about that for a minute. Can you imagine what would have happened in 2008 if it had turned out that Barack Obama had a credit card from the Bank of China? $1,000 credit card. Can you imagine how that would be used to destroy him? If John Kerry had a loan somewhere, or his wife had had a loan somewhere on a piece of property, and the mortgage was from the communist-owned Bank of China, that would have been an enormous scandal. And I'm at a loss to understand why this is not a huge scandal now, particularly when compounded by the fact that Trump, by his own account and one of his son's accounts, has disproportionately relied on Russian oligarchs for revenue and investments. And you'll notice that every time the name Vladimir Putin comes out, Donald Trump goes out of his way to express his admiration and respect for Vladimir Putin. To those of us who've read many tape recordings of mob guys that the FBI or state police in various places have obtained, one of the things that you learn from listening to many of these and reading many transcripts is that if the boss is mentioned, people gratuitously talk about how great the boss is. They want to make sure everybody's heard how much they admire and look up to the boss. They never say a critical word. Trump does the exact same thing with Vladimir Putin, this murderous autocrat in Moscow. And yet, it hardly gets attention from American voters. It is as bizarre as the fact that in a number of states, we had these big political fights about transgendered bathrooms and can a person who's going from being a man to a woman, for example, use the women's bathroom pre-surgery. And yet Donald Trump walked in the dressing room with naked girls as young as 15 years old at one of the beauty pageants he owned. And, you know, people are not revulsed and running away from him at high speed. That's just astonishing, the hypocrisy of that.
The respect that you must pay for the number one person reminds me of years ago, and you may not have been in New York at the time, where the chalices were stolen from Carlo Gambino's church. And Carlo said, I'd like to get the chalices back. And funny thing, they came back.
I just can't imagine why they suddenly reappeared. Yeah.
Over the years before the current, and I must say, widely acclaimed making of Donald Trump, do publish many exposés relating to him, and they're all covered in the book. Let me go through a few of them now. First, his constant self-promotion of himself, best on shaky grounds, his approbation of Penn's renowned graduate school to his history, when in fact he went to the undergrad school and not the graduate school, his constant misstatement of his wealth and his business successes, his claims of a charitable contribution that no one can find, and his shadow organizations to give him awards. Why do you think that he does, particularly now, when he has to know that some David K. Johnson will dig up the true story?
Oh, because in the world of the world here is ruled by television. So long as I'm not getting on to the network news, which I haven't been on in America, I've been on the national broadcast television shows of Australia, Japan, Canada, Britain, France, and Germany, but not ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS, in the interview they did for me for a Sunday show, cut out every reference to Donald Trump and criminals. Donald Trump is a master salesman, and he has created this image, and for reasons that I find absolutely stupefying, I turn on network news and I see people who don't know anything about Trump saying things that are nonsense, and they're not having me on. But, you know, that's their choice. Their news organization, they can decide what they want to do. But Trump doesn't care about what print does in this election. He stopped banning news organizations. His latest crew helping him with the campaign got him to undo that. But every news organization that he banned from his campaign events was a print organization. He banned the Washington Post. He didn't ban NBC. He banned the Daily Beast, who I write a column for. He didn't ban CBS. He's astute about that. And he knows that in TV, they don't have time for nuance and time for taking things apart, and that most Americans, frankly, are not steeped in following fine detail. If you walk into a bar, I was giving a speech in Massachusetts a couple of weeks ago, and the only place when my plane landed I could find it open was a sports bar. And all around me there are these different guys, and they're dissecting in great detail the sporting events that they were interested in, football and baseball. And people who do this, but if you bring up politics, I don't want to talk about that, or I don't know anything about that. It's just amazing the brain power we put into this fun but trivial activities of commercial sports, but we don't put the same effort into deep thought about our democracy.
Yeah, one of the many things in this respect that particularly galls me was his statement that he had military experience because he went to military school. I went to military school and was in the Army, and there's a big, big difference. And I was only in for 6 months and never in combat. And then he later goes on to say he knows more about ISIS than the generals. Does he really expect us to believe this?
Oh, he expects you to believe it. Absolutely. Donald has always done this. He creates his own reality. And he learned some of this from his father. His father gouged government programs to finance housing for returning veterans of World War II. He ended up with $4 million more than he was supposed to have. And this is mid-1950s. So we're talking about in today's money, $35 million or so, more than he was supposed to have. And when President Eisenhower learned about this, and Fred Trump was not the only person who did it, there were some others, but he was the star witness, the star case. Eisenhower threw a fit in the Oval Office. And the reason we know that is 100 investigators were assigned to this case as soon as Eisenhower found out about it. The Senate hauled Fred Trump before them to testify, and he says, no, this is all a misunderstanding. You don't understand. I am not a war profiteer. I am not profiting off the taxpayers and off the GIs. Yes, there's $4 million there, but it's in the bank. I didn't take it. I mean, that is such a laughably absurd defense. You left it in your own bank account, so you're not a profiteer. It's irrelevant. And Donald learned from his father things like this and took them to a much bigger scale. When his father wanted to build what would have been the first apartment building with the Trump name on it out at Coney Island, he had to destroy a popular ride called the Steeplechase, and there was opposition to this. So what did he do? He hired a bunch of young women in what were for 1966, scandalous bikinis, very curvy women in these bikinis, and he had them hand out bricks to public officials and others to throw at the funny face, which was the symbol of the ride, to destroy it. So Donald Trump didn't come out of nowhere. Daddy was a small-scale version of what you've seen in Donald Trump as a showman.
Second, his whole business history flies in the face of the present political statements. He has built a campaign that began with his attack on illegal immigration, yet, as you describe in the book, his firm engaged the construction contractor that he or at least his staff had to know were using illegal Polish workers, paying them less than the minimum wage, working them long hours without overtime, and not providing them even with minimal health safety gear. Could you tell the audience about that story?
Sure. Well, to build Trump Tower, Trump had to tear down the Bonwit Teller department store, a 12-story building in Midtown Manhattan. And it had two beautiful Art Deco sculptures on the front. They were sort of outlines of women dancing with scarves, and they were considered preeminent examples of Art Deco, the Art Deco era. Trump promised to give them to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Then he had them destroyed, and he used a fake PR man named John Barron to declare that they were worthless. They had no artistic value whatsoever. Mr. Trump has concluded they had no artistic value. Yeah, Donald Trump knows more than the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Well, to tear down the building, instead of hiring an experienced demolition contractor, he hired a window washing firm from Syracuse, New York, and that guy used between 150 to 200, depending on what day it was, 150 to 200 illegal immigrants from Poland. They became known as the Polish Brigade. They were supposed to get $4 an hour, which would be about 12 bucks an hour in today's money. They were so poor that in the middle of winter, the work started the beginning of January, many of them slept in the building. When they didn't get paid, they took Trump's guy over to the edge of one of the high floors and threatened to hang him over the side of it unless they got paid right away, whereupon, after a short period of time, cash suddenly materialized. Trump had an office across the street on Fifth Avenue so he could look at the site, and he was often photographed and videotaped at the site with a hard hat on. After the demolition was completed, and these guys had no hard hats, no safety goggles. They were stripping live wires with their bare hands, and the building was full of asbestos, but they didn't have even the most rudimentary face masks. One of the members of the House Wreckers Union sued. Now, about 15 workers on the site were from the union and 150 were non-union. Any construction site in America, a bunch of non-union guys show up, work just stops. In this case, they were under the control of the mob, the union was. So this very brave guy, Harry Diddick, filed a lawsuit, and the judge, after a trial, found that Donald Trump's testimony that he didn't know was not credible, that Donald Trump engaged in a conspiracy to cheat these men out of their pay, The struggle went on for 18 years, 18 years over $4 an hour. And in the end, Donald Trump settled and paid something, but we don't know how much, because he demanded that the terms of the settlement be sealed. It's pretty extraordinary that you're unwilling to pay people such a tiny wage, especially after a judge has found you engaged in a conspiracy to cheat people. Almost nobody in America knows this. I haven't, you know, when a few times I've seen it mentioned on TV, nobody has laid out the significance of this. It had a second significance, John, and that is later when Trump owed his bankers $3.2 billion and couldn't pay his bills. He said he was a billionaire, but he couldn't pay any of his bills, including $900 million plus that he owed on his signature. Think of it as a giant credit card because it wasn't secured by anything but his signature. The bankers settled with him for two reasons. One was he made it clear he would tie him up in litigation for years, and if you're willing to do it over $4 an hour, imagine how much litigation you'll tie people up in for nearly $1 billion. And because Trump got the state of New Jersey's Casino Control Commission to take his side against his bankers. And that was politically easy to understand. The bankers are in New York and London and Germany, whereas Trump was a major employer in New Jersey. Not hard for the politicians to decide to take the side of the local employer against distant bankers.
Yeah. Third, I'm most following the election of generally about his constant misstatement of the value of his assets, which you just mentioned, whether he was puffing himself or attempting to reduce tax assessments. But you take the reader to an in-depth analysis from the Taj Mahal to the real estate in New York to the golf courses. Tell us something about this history.
Well, the most important thing to understand about Donald Trump's business deals, with one exception, Trump University, which is a scam, is that Trump never puts up any money. He never had $1 invested in Atlantic City. From the first casino, he got, I think it was $39 million in fees up front. From the second one, he borrowed all the money and took a $5 million fee off the top. From the third one, he borrowed money and took a fee off the top. That's the standard Trump business deal. I get money up front. You know, you're lucky if you can get paid. And in buying the Trump shuttle, which failed very quickly because he thought if he put in what he said were gold sinks and gold buckles on the seatbelts, and what he said was authentic bird's eye maple trim, that people would pay a much higher price for their, you know, 37-minute flight between Washington and New York. He also bought the airline had more than 20 Boeing 727 jets, which were gas guzzlers, and they were all more than 20 years old except one. And it failed quickly. He overpaid for properties, but all of this with borrowed money, not his own money. And so when the business got in trouble, Trump could walk away from these deals. That's why the name of his first book, The Art of the Deal, is significant. Basically, so long as he can keep making new deals, it doesn't matter if the businesses fail, he'll just keep getting more money.
Yeah. Well, fourth, and extremely troubling as I read the book, the Donald comes off as more than someone cutting business corners. He comes off as the plain and simple crook. The public knows about charges of an alleged bribe to Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of Florida, that led to her dropping the investigation into the discredited Trump University. What they don't in all probability know, if they haven't read your book, is his partnership with convicted felons in a helicopter business, his plea for leniency for a convicted drug trafficker, his close business dealings with Joe Kanji, I guess it's pronounced, known in gangster parlance as Joey Nose Socks and the Preppy Don, as well as with a stock swindler and convicted felon for stabbing a person, Felix Sater. Why has this not all come out other than in your book during this campaign?
John, I am just flabbergasted about this because everything you just talked about is from public records. There are 44 pages of source notes in the back of my book and my personal email. And there's maybe 10 or 15 people from the U.S. and other countries who have emailed me to ask some question from the book. but this is all public record. Trump, for his entire life, has been in the embrace of violent felons, embezzlers, mob associates, and not just American Mafia mob associates. And most importantly, his personal helicopter and his casino's helicopters were provided and managed not by one of the many reasonably well-run helicopter companies, but by one run by this mob associate named Joe Wechselbaum. Wechselbaum was also a major cocaine trafficker, and when he got caught in Cincinnati, Ohio, he agreed to plead guilty. The case was then mysteriously moved to New Jersey to federal judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald's older sister. She recused herself from the case, but, you know, just think about that conversation for a minute. She had to go down the hall to the chief judge and say, listen, I can't handle this case because I fly, and so does my husband, who's a lawyer for Donald Trump's casinos, in this drug trafficker's helicopters. You're the chief judge. You suddenly have a federal judge who is routinely flying in the helicopters of a major confessed cocaine trafficker. Well, Donald wrote a letter pleading for mercy for Joe Wechselbaum. He called him a credit to the community, and he initially tried to lie and cover up. When that didn't work, he acknowledged that he had signed the letter, but nothing in the record suggests he was asked any of the obvious questions that would flow out of that, like, well, why did you do this? What would prompt you? Because the Casino Control Act says you may not associate with criminals. You could lose your license for this. So why would you risk your casino license to show your loyalty to a major cocaine trafficker? And keep in mind what I said earlier about how he goes out of his way to show his fealty to Vladimir Putin. Trump should be asked about this all over the place, and nobody's asking. I tried to ask him about it when he called me at home April 27th, and he quickly got off the subject. Don't remember this. Long time ago. Don't remember any of that. I reminded him not long after he had declared that he has the world's greatest memory. It's an incredibly, you know, convenient memory that he has. He remembers what he wants and forgets what he doesn't want. At least that's what he tells you. So this is astonishing to me. We have never had a president, certainly in modern times, and certainly not since after the Civil War, with the kind of criminal connections Trump has. I spoke to Professor Douglas Brinkley, who's a presidential historian at Rice University, about this, and we talked about Warren G. Harding. Well, Warren G. Harding ran one of the most corrupt administrations in American history. The difference is that Harding's pals were businessmen who did corrupt things. Trump's pals are criminals who own businesses. That's a big difference.
Yeah. Your book also deals with the business dealings, as you mentioned earlier, of Trump's father and grandfather, and points out the charges of bias against his father's firm at a time when Donald was already active in the business. This has also not been hammered at him by the press. Is this lack of the question due to the fact that Trump's constant aggression against other candidates and the press constantly has the media back on its heels?
Well, you know, Trump very carefully controls access to himself. He's lately only made himself available in person to Sean Hannity, who always tells you he's not a journalist, he's an entertainer. The crowds, it's been reported, at Trump events are very menacing, and of course he keeps the reporters in the pen. So the few times reporters have asked anything in the nature of a tough question, there are these huge boos from the crowd, and Donald turns it into a way to escape having to go down that road. He has not had to sit down and be grilled as he should be, as every presidential candidate should be, by reporters who know their stuff. And the TV events, the debates in the primaries and in the general election, what you're seeing are television personalities. They may work in news, but most of them are not heavyweight reporters. If they worked in the newsroom of one of the top newspapers, most of them would be regarded as, you know, pretty good reporters, but not the top tier. And a couple of them would get the worst thing that can be said about you in a newsroom, which is to be called a lightweight. So Trump's managed to escape scrutiny about these things, and editorial pages who should be hitting this and demanding answers, even if they know they're not going to get them, have done a terrible job about this by and large. And I think this is very troubling. I mean, the press in America is much less aggressive than it used to be. I once told a general officer of the U.S. Army, "General, stop lying to me. If you lie one more time, I will make sure every junior officer knows that you're a liar. Now, if you don't want to answer my question, then don't answer my question, but do not lie to me. Now, I'm going to ask you again." I think today you'd get fired for that.
Probably.
Yeah. Back then was just fine, but today I think you'd get fired for it.
When Dan Rathis said, "No, Mr. President," do you, if you remember?
Yes. Oh, yes.
One question, something I didn't see in the book, and I'm interested because I'm not sure that I have the right answer. Whenever I ask people about what has Trump actually done in New York City, a bunch of them point to the ice skating rink. My memory was that he said he was going to do the ice skating rink. He did it for 1 year, but he made a commitment for 2 or for 5 years, and he walked away. Do you know anything about that deal?
Well, yeah. No. What the important part about the ice skating rink is this. He has told everybody it was a pro bono project, and there's a wonderful documentary that your listeners can rent for $2.99 on iTunes called Trump, What's the Deal? It's only 80 minutes long. Trump, What's the Deal? Trump suppressed that documentary in 1990 or 91 when it came out with threats of litigation. But Trump, What's the Deal? Handles this very, very well. They quote a guy who says that, well, Trump said he's doing this pro bono project to fix up Wallman Rink, which years and years just didn't get rebuilt in the corner of Central Park by the Plaza Hotel. And he did the work, this contractor, for free because Donald said it was public service. Well, no, Donald got paid $10 million. In today's money, that's about $25 million. By the city. And in addition, he got the contract for the carousel, which makes him, I think the revenues, it's in his presidential campaign report, but it makes him a significant amount of money. I think it's a couple $100,000 a year. But this is classic Trump. I'm doing this as a public service, and I'm not telling people I got paid $10 million. And then he gets contractors, at least some of them, to do the work for free because it's a public service project. That's just mind-boggling.
We could talk about the book until tomorrow morning, and I encourage my listeners, if they don't already have a copy, to get online and ordered right after the show, but we'd run out of time. What else do you want the listeners to know about the book?
Well, in the making of Donald Trump, I tried to give people a deep and quick read about who he actually is. And the Houston Chronicle has a blogger named Charlie Cuff who this week or a few days ago said in his blog, however much you think you know about how awful Donald Trump is, if you haven't read The Making of Donald Trump, you have no idea. And I thought, that's exactly right. It is, and people post all the time, my Twitter feed and elsewhere, that once they've read the book, they go, my goodness, this is far worse than I ever possibly imagined. And people have posted that in the days since the accusations of groping and walking in on naked 15-year-old girls. The implied threats that he wants his opponent jailed or assassinated. There's very serious stuff in The Making of Donald Trump that people really do need to understand. And, you know, he's not going away. If he wins the election, I'm going to have lots of problems with the federal government. But if he doesn't win, he's going to make a new living with some kind of new television or radio operation with Roger Ailes and Steve Bannon. And he's going to foment trouble. He's going to appeal to racists and bigots and encourage violence, just as he's been doing in the campaign, in order to build up money for himself, because there isn't the huge pile of assets he suggests, but more importantly, his ego demands it. Just never forget, Donald Trump believes he is superior to the rest of us and, of course, should be president. And as one of his sons said, they believe that they are genetically superior to the rest of us.
There's an article in in a current New Republic, there's a column suggesting that it may be worse for the country to have him lose by a little than to win, because if he wins, he'll find out very rapidly from the Constitution and the Supreme Court and the and Congress that he can't do all these crazy things that he talks about. But if he loses by just a little, it'll be crooked. It'll be crooked Hillary. It'll be fixed.
Donald has been setting up that if he loses by any sort of not horrendous margin, they stole the election. Rudy Giuliani, I was watching on TV today, saying that, you know, there are people who come in and vote 10 times in Pennsylvania, even though when there was a lawsuit over voter fraud in Pennsylvania, both sides agreed they couldn't find a single case of voter fraud. That didn't happen. But if Trump is elected, I don't think he can get through 1 year without being impeached and convicted, because he doesn't understand the duties, powers, and limits of the presidency. If he's tried and removed from office, that is, he doesn't find military officers to take over, and I think that is a clear and present danger, then what we get is President Mike Pence, and I don't think that's much better.
Well, the New Republic's answer was that he has to be swamped. You mentioned Giuliani. I think that's very sad, because he's gone from America's mayor and his wonderful performance right at 9/11 to so far downhill that he's just a
let me suggest to you reading the book by the great Wayne Barrett, Grand Illusion, Wayne Barrett and Dan Collins. And what they do is show that what everybody saw on 9/11 was a fraud. And they go through it with meticulous detail, showing how Rudy Giuliani was getting videotape and creating an image when, in fact, he was damaging the work of the first responders. He was putting people's lives in danger. And how the emergency command center was destroyed because he rejected everybody's advice about putting it in Brooklyn. And the reason was Giuliani had a bedroom over there where he could take women on your and my dime as taxpayers, and that he also wouldn't get the radios that the police and fire department said they needed, particularly the fire department. And a lot of those firefighters never heard to clear the building because Giuliani's actions. It was Grand Illusion by Wayne Barrett and Dan Collins is a book that really takes apart Giuliani the same way the making of Donald Trump uses facts to take apart Donald Trump.
I will read it, and the great picture that's been going around Facebook is just the picture of him with Hillary right next to him, and it says under it he didn't remember seeing her there at 9/11.
She was there the next day. She came on the 12th.
Right.
But Trump is always saying she didn't do anything for people in New York. She's the one who got George W. Bush to agree to the billions of dollars of aid that New York. And by the way, Donald Trump, whose buildings weren't at all damaged, got $150,000 from a fund for small businessmen and businesswomen who were hurt by 9/11.
You mentioned your book on Undivided, and then you also mentioned the worst case scenario of if Trump gets elected or just loses by little. We're a very divided country now. How do we come together after this election, assuming Hillary wins?
Well, I think that this is going to be a real challenge. We have very deep-seated problems in our democracy that I've talked about for many years. We have a large number of people who cannot seem to cope with the changing world in which we live because human knowledge is expanding at a horrendous rate. A lot of people are terrified of science. That's part of what you see in the denial of climate change science. There are a lot of people who are – I mean, I've written a lot about how the bottom 90% of Americans have real grievances about government policy, and both parties are ignoring them and focusing on the interests of the tenth of 1% and up. And so this is a real problem. We have a broad attack – Mike Pence is a leader of it – on public education, because if you – believe the earth is 6,000 years old and other fairy tales, you don't want secular public education. You want religious education. And so you just starve public education. as most best you can. And we got real challenges, and this is not Hillary Clinton's agenda to address these things, at least so far. I mean, we'll see what happens if she becomes president. But our democracy is in very deep trouble, and it's part of the reason that I wrote The Making of Donald Trump. I say at the end of the book, you know, you should read books about Hillary Clinton. I don't know her. That's why I didn't write about her. Never met her. Never talked to her. But I do know Trump. And if after reading this book and learning what I tell you about Donald Trump and who he really is, if you still want to vote for him for president, at least you know who you're voting for. So.
I see we have the caller on the line who I know has read your book. Good evening, Phyllis. You're on the line with Donald K. Johnston.
David K. Johnston.
David K. Johnston. I'm sorry, I just mixed you up.
That's all right, John.
Go ahead, Phyllis.
Hi, Phyllis.
Oh, she's not speaking, so I guess she's not listening. What's next for you, David?
Well, I'm going to go back to my book, The Prosperity Tax. The tax code that we have is designed for an industrial era with cash wage incomes, and we don't live in that world anymore. The most valuable things that we have in America today can be reduced to a piece of paper, and as I wrote about in my book, Perfectly Legal, you can put them in a letter and send them to some other place and have all the tax revenues disappear as you siphon the money out of the country, which is what the big multinationals like Apple and General Electric have been doing for years, damaging our economy. So we have to have an entirely new tax code. And the one I'm drafting, my goal is to be under 100 pages. The current U.S. tax code in its official government version is a little under 6,500 pages. And my goal is to get under 100.
When do you hope to have the book out, David?
Beginning of 2018, early 2018.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about David K. Johnston?
There's a lot of good, serious investigative reporting done in this country. I was the head of my professional association, Investigative Reporters and Editors. The problem is what's called beat reporting. We have city councils that haven't had a reporter attend them in years. State legislatures, which are vitally important to the quality of your life, nobody covers them with any depth because there aren't enough reporters. In New York State, the government is about to approve a high-pressure natural gas pipeline that will be 105 feet from critical infrastructure of the Indian Point nuclear power plant. Now, the odds of an explosion of a pipeline and one happening at exactly that point, especially a new pipeline, are very, very, very small. But if it did happen, it would be so catastrophic we would have to abandon, depending on where the wind is blowing, all of New York City. Why would we run a pipeline 105 feet away from critical nuclear infrastructure? Doesn't mean don't have the nuclear power plant. Doesn't mean don't have the pipeline. It's just, why wouldn't you reroute the pipeline to a safer distance if it turns into a giant blowtorch? And I've been covering this story from Rochester, New York, where I live, and writing columns about it for more than a year. It's not getting coverage anywhere else because nobody covers the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the New York State Public Service Commission with any regularity. That's the crisis. And if people think, you know, well, I can get all my news for free on Google, I got news for you. You're going to get what you pay for.
And I live about less than 20 minutes from Indian Point. So that's...
Well, I hope you give some coverage to this thing, John, and we'll talk on another occasion in the future, maybe when my next book comes out. But for right now, it's The Making of Donald Trump.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's been a real pleasure tonight.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Take care.
A bit of commercial information. My last column in the Creative Disruption series appears in West of the Guardian, along with columns by ex-Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon, among others this week. It's still online at www.westofguardian.com. Pick up your collector's copy. My book's available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words, the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, we hope we speak to you next week. And good night, everybody. As they say in the old neighborhood, see ya.